I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Silicon Valley leads the way in innovation and technology, but falls far short in one particular area, a diverse workforce. One man has a vision to change that part of the tech world, not in California, but here in Kansas City. And not downtown or in Westport or the Plaza, but on 22 acres just south of the 18th and Vine Jazz District. Then, one of my favorite Flint Hill residents, Cindy Hodel, stops by. She'll tell us how life's been since her layoff from the newspaper world, what changes she's seeing in her corner of Chase County, and what's new at the homestead. We'll have some new music, too, as Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Diversity is on many companies' minds as this country's workforce undergoes a huge demographic shift. Silicon Valley is one of the worst offenders when it comes to inclusiveness among employees. Companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter have all been under fire for their mostly white and mostly male staffs. But here in Kansas City, one businessman wants to help Kansas City avoid the dilemma of Silicon Valley by building a tech hub with diversity hardwired into its core. To tell that story, we bring you an episode of We Live Here, a podcast based at St. Louis Public Radio and featuring the work of KCUR's own Lisa Rodriguez.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here. We're going to be spending a lot of time in Kansas City on this episode, so now would be a good time to introduce you to our tour guide, Lisa Rodriguez.
Lisa's a reporter at KCUR, the public radio station in Kansas City. How's it going, Lisa?
Hey, guys. It's going great.
Cool.
All right. So let's get started. What's the local tech scene look like in Kansas City?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that just like about everywhere, Kansas City wants to become a hub of entrepreneurial activity. Here's Kansas City Mayor Sly James speaking at the White House earlier this year.
I don't create jobs. We simply try to build an environment in which jobs can foster, and we've done that by promoting entrepreneurism and startups.
So you get the picture.
We get the picture. Mm-hmm. But is it safe to assume that, again, like other cities in the country, the tech scene in Kansas City is also lacking in diversity?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a lot of other cities across the country. It's mostly white and mostly male. But I'm going to be telling the story of one guy who isn't waiting on the tech giants to make the tech industry more inclusive for black and brown entrepreneurs. His name is V. Weiser Dixon, and he goes by V for short. His whole childhood is encapsulated in about 1 square mile around Kansas City's historic Jazz District. And the first time I met him, he gave me a tour of his old neighborhood. So we hopped into his old minivan, accompanied by his 8-year-old grandson, Roman.
Roman, you're going to have to be quiet now, okay? Because you're on the radio, all right?
Me?
No, yeah, but you have to be quiet.
I'm on the radio?
I think you're going to be on the radio.
And as we start making the rounds, it seems like everyone around here knows V. People waved to us from their cars.
Hey, man. All right.
We dropped into a local barbershop where the owner, Joey, sang his praises.
Yeah, V for president.
V for president?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we popped into several offices to say hello.
Gentlemen of the jury. Hey, what's up? I brought somebody in here. They want to interview you guys.
Oh, really?
We get back into his minivan and continue our tour. We drive past his old elementary school.
This is where I went to school right here. Right here on this tree, you'll see my initials and my first girlfriend's initials right here on this tree right here.
When was that? What grade were you in?
I believe I was more like in the maybe third grade or fourth grade, something like that. I was a bad little boy.
This was back in the 1950s and 60s, and at the time, V's neighborhood, the Jazz District, was one of the city's most vibrant black neighborhoods.
African Americans had ownership, professionals such as lawyers, restaurants, nightclubs, you know, the streetcar, you know, all that. It was a very vibrant community at that time.
But these days, the neighborhood is a shell of its former self. Empty storefronts, aging buildings, and big sections of empty, overgrown land. We drive by stretches where people have left huge piles of trash on the side of the street.
Yeah, somebody's dumping again.
V has an ambitious idea he thinks could breathe new life into this part of town. As city leaders push to make Kansas City the next tech magnet, V has purchased 22 acres of land just south of the main drag in the Jazz District. He wants to build a sort of tech hub centered on entrepreneurs of color. There would be co-working spaces, apartments, and business incubators.
Yeah, it'd be an urban technology and research park. Some developers might call it a mixed-use development, but kind of focused on Kansas City's being a startup city.
Officially, it would be called the Enterprise Village Ecosystem, or EVE. The Kansas City Star dubbed it a Black Silicon Valley. But if you ask V, he likes to refer to it as the New Promised Land. The biblical reference is no coincidence. V's also an ordained minister. I'll tell you more about that in just a little bit. But for now, you should know that at the same time V is trying to get his project off the ground, the marketplace for tech development in Kansas City is getting crowded. Less than 4 miles away from where V wants to build his project, construction has already started on a different co-working space, billed by developers as the world's biggest co-working studio. And developments like that are popping up all over Kansas City as the town vies with other cities to become this Midwestern tech mecca. With all that investment, it begs the question, does the city need another startup hub with such a specific target? I called 5 or 6 people in the entrepreneur and tech scene around town, and the initial reviews are mixed. Some people I talked to kind of balked at the term Black Silicon Valley, saying it sounded divisive and exclusive. But a lot of people said, whether or not we like to admit it, Kansas City isn't really inclusive to entrepreneurs of color, and that a space like this, if V can pull it off, would be great.
Overall, I think it's a great idea.
Lewis Bird is the founder of a company called Melly Blue, which consults with businesses who want to be more inclusive. I met up with him at a popular coffee shop in Kansas City. He says Black and brown startup founders around here tend to be put in a box. He tells me a story about going to Tech Week KC. It's this big event in the local startup community that featured tons of panels on all sorts of different topics, like artificial intelligence, big data, and marketing. But most of the Black and brown entrepreneurs, including Lewis, were all on the same panel, the diversity panel.
And this isn't unique to Kansas City, it's everywhere, right? But there's elements of a lot of non-inclusiveness that it just happens. And we see it from, you know, the venture capitalists, who do they fund? You see it to people being invited to certain things. And I mean, it's definitely there.
He says the problem is the startup community isn't really ready to admit that it has a problem. Around here, people like to throw around the phrase Kansas City nice. You can think of it kind of like a mix of Midwestern humility and Southern hospitality. Locals really like to pat themselves on the back for it. But this folksy charm can have a downside, like turning a blind eye to the fact that in a city that's about 30% Black, the local startup scene is almost entirely white and male. Lewis says he saw the Kansas City Nice effect very clearly at the Tech Week KC conference.
I brought up inclusion, and then, like, honestly, the energy in the room shifted. It was just like, what do you mean inclusion? And you can see everybody tensing up.
I heard a similar story from a woman named Felicia Hatcher. She's one of the founders of Black Tech Week, and she was in Kansas City about a year ago. I reached her on her phone in her home base of Miami.
One guy that pretty much heads, from the introduction of his panel, kind of heads the startup ecosystem, kind of building and activity in Kansas City, I had a conversation with him, and I was like, you know, this is what we're doing in South Florida. Like, you know, what are you guys doing to engage, like, the African-American community in Kansas City? And his words have stuck with me since, because he's like, we're just trying to figure out the startup part first before we even think about diversity. His words stuck with me because I'm like, that is the reason we have this problem all across the United States.
you could probably parachute into any town having this conversation about diversity in tech and hear a lot of the same issues that Felicia brings up. And clearly, V is onto something by positioning his project, Eve, as a way to fill the void for entrepreneurs of color. But is he the right guy to pull it off in Kansas City? V's no stranger to starting his own successful business and helping others get their ideas off the ground. V has a degree in mechanical engineering, and he first caught the entrepreneurial bug while he was working as a parts buyer for Ford. Originally, V set his sights on getting into the steel business, but at the time, the bottom was falling out of that market. Meanwhile, back in Kansas City, his dad, who's a doctor, had purchased an office building to start his own practice. There was some open space in the building, and V spotted an opportunity. He figured he could open up a fast food chicken wing restaurant and pair it with something else that was pretty rare at the time.
Now, right here on this corner on 18th and Brooklyn was our incubator. Now you see it as a parking lot.
Think about that. V started a business incubator in Kansas City in the 1980s.
You know, we had this big old building. We didn't know we needed to fill it up with tenants. And if you had an idea, dream, or vision, you know, we would help you go into business in order to create, you know, this incubator type or cluster of small businesses that would be, you know, feed one another.
One of his first tenants was Lucy McFadden. She was 24 and a recent beauty school graduate. When she met V, she and her sister were looking to rent booth space in a salon that a different gentleman was running in V's building. Shortly after they moved in, though, her sister moved to Hawaii, leaving Lucy two spaces to pay for.
And so when she moved, I thought my rent would double, which at that time I wasn't able to afford that. So I went to talk to V, you know, and V's like, oh, Lucy, just keep paying what you're paying, you know, don't even worry about it. And which I was surprised because, you know, I had two big rooms and, you know, so anyway, V just let me continue to work. And so when the gentleman left that owned the salon, I went again to talk to V about taking it over, you know, and he's like, of course. And I didn't have to go in with a lump sum paying for the business because there was already stylists in there working. So basically, you know, I just started paying him and took the business over. I didn't know anything about owning a salon. You know, V kind of took a chance on me, you know.
Now Lucy has four salons. I also talked to some of V's lifelong friends. They say he was constantly helping other people start businesses. And even if they turned around and failed, he didn't really sweat it. But while he was also having this success in business, he still had a pretty big internal conflict. Remember when I mentioned that V is also a minister? Well, that's actually been a bit of a struggle for him. See, V's always grappled with this idea of wanting to dedicate his life to God and wanting to run a business.
You can't serve God and money at the same time. You're going to love one or hate the other. How hard it is to serve two masters. You're going to love one or hate the other. And so it was taught to me, the elders that I grew up, that, hey, either you got to be in business and be a businessman, or you got to be a preacher or whatever it is that you've called to do in ministry, but you can't mix the two.
Eventually, V says he had to make a choice.
I had a call of God on my life.
And that call would take him far from Kansas City. V went to Egypt to get ordained and then was a minister in the Virgin Islands. His big break from business lasted about 10 years. Then in 2004, V made a move again, this time back home to Kansas City. And he wasn't thrilled with what he saw. It seemed as if his old neighborhood, the Jazz District, had been left behind other parts of the city. So he approached his friends at the Black Economic Union, opened an office, and quietly acquired about 22 acres of land he wants to transform into Eve, the Enterprise Village ecosystem. V says he's finally reconciled that he doesn't have to be behind the pulpit to serve God.
I've always seen Jesus, even as a little boy, in the marketplace. He didn't have a church home. You know, he did all his miracles in the marketplace. He healed the sick, the blind, and all the above that know about his works. He recruited business people such as Peter, Paul. They were fishermen, accountants. He didn't recruit not one, pastor or preacher or clergy in his day. They were all businessmen and regular people just like me and you.
So V has his vision, and there's a need for the type of project he's trying to build.
On top of that, he's finally made peace with his internal conflict between religion and business. But coming up, it will take more than faith for him to succeed.
To vet V's idea, I went to Felicia Hatcher. We heard from her earlier. She's one of the founders of Black Tech Week and travels a lot, consulting for people who want to build startup communities. She's also given numerous TEDx talks and been recognized by the White House 3 separate times for her work in entrepreneurship and social change. She's a champion for ideas like V's.
He's hitting the nail on the head as far as addressing that problem and addressing that problem in the community. That can definitely benefit from it when all the pieces of the pie come together.
And when I talked with Felicia, she laid out what 4 of those pieces would be. So let's go down the list. Piece number 1.
K-12 has to be involved, because that's starting that activity and that's starting that education and kind of non-traditional skills-based education very early.
On that front, V's project is pretty well situated. Bordering on one side of his property, there's a new elementary school that focuses on science and technology. And on another border of his property is Lincoln Prep, where V went to high school. He says both schools are eager to work with him when he gets his project off the ground. So V gets a check mark on this one. And sticking with education, piece number 2.
A really strong university partner. Has to be a part of that conversation. It has to be a part of that plan.
V has letters of support from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which has some student housing just a few blocks away, and from Avila University. Both have stated interest in opening programs in V's development once it's built. So I'll give him a check mark on that one, too. This brings us to big thing number 3, workforce development.
Training with boot camps, with hackathons and all those things. Like, where are those taking place? Targeting that community in Kansas City right now. And if they're not, then that's something that has to be added in order for that to be sustainable.
V's made some inroads on that front too. So another check mark. And finally, big thing number 4, infrastructure, both intellectual and physical.
A co-working space that allows those businesses to kind of come in, be incubated, or go through some sort of accelerator that has a focus on minority businesses in order to give them kind of like the wraparound support that they need to actually be able to flourish in that area.
That's the element that V is planning on building, a mix of residences, retail space, and offices. So V got pretty good grades as far as being on the right track with his idea. He's already thought about all of the components of an innovation district that Felicia set out.
Okay, Lisa, we got to cut in here.
Yeah, because we've got a few questions. So far, this all sounds really great, but what about the people who are already living in the Jazz District?
Well, that's complicated. Let me give you some context. I've already mentioned V's not the only one focused on reshaping the Jazz District. The city of Kansas City is pouring millions into the same part of town, and it's been getting loads of pushback.
Why's that?
Well, for decades, developers and city officials have made big promises to residents living in the neighborhood. In fact, the city's put more than $100 million into revitalizing the area. But despite all of this, not much has changed recently. So people living there now are skeptical of anyone who comes in with some big idea.
So this all sounds very similar to what we've heard here in St. Louis and really every city in America from Black residents who've been promised huge changes in their neighborhood and really nothing has happened.
Exactly. So many who are here living in Kansas City are just unimpressed or skeptical of the city's latest promise, which is to invest $27 million into the area just north of V's land, which is the most famous stretch of the Jazz District.
I kept hearing this thing over and over, is that we want white people to come down here. I don't. You know, I really want economic development for the people that live here.
That's the voice of a woman who didn't want to give her name during a town hall this past summer about the city's plans. KCUR hosted the forum to give residents a chance to talk about the city's plans for the Jazz District. And a lot of speakers, like Gaylord Kushine, say redevelopment plans aren't designed with current residents in mind.
There's only one segment of people here that are going to be able to enjoy it, and they won't look like us.
And here's Marvin Lyman. He's the president of the Black Economic Union, pointing out how slow progress has been in the Jazz District, which is mostly Black, compared to northern parts of Kansas City, which are mostly white.
It's amazing how Zona Rosa popped up. It's amazing how Briarcliff popped up. It's amazing how all these other developments pop up, and they're not 5 years one business, 5 years another business, 5 years now we need a parking garage. Some of us just can read just a little bit to understand economic development.
So how does V plan to get around some of the skepticism and resistance?
Well, remember, he's got a couple of things in his favor. First, almost all of the land he wants to build on is currently empty. It's covered in overgrown brush.
So no one would be forcibly removed from their homes or anything like that.
Right. The second thing that works to V's advantage is that he's an insider, and he thinks that's going to help him cut through the infighting among various groups in the area and get things done with the help of local leaders who, quite frankly, look like him.
You got a black mayor, you got black county legislator, you got black council people. You know, as far as politics is concerned and development is concerned, all these things, if you go to any other city, how many times do we have that the stars line up like that to where we can really make some things happen? We've got several wealthy business people that could come down here, and if we can all just sit down and join hands and say, we're going to figure this thing out, and we're going to make some things happen. And I believe in them. You know, I believe that they will. I think they're starting to see that. Maybe I'm just in, I live in this hocus-pocus dream world, but that's my prayer.
Which brings us right to V's biggest challenge, money. I asked him on multiple occasions whether he had investors lined up to pay for this, and I never really got a good answer. His response was always, we're getting ready to close the deal. I know he's counting on the city to pitch in at some point, but the more people I talk to, the less confident I am that the city will actually come through with any funding at all. Quentin Lucas is the city council member who represents the Jazz District, and he's doubtful much, if any, money will come from the city.
You know, I'll say this. There's going to have to be a time when all of us in city government start to think about how much money are we going to put into specific areas as opposed to actually saying, okay, we put in our investment, and then from there we're going to leverage dollars thereafter. So what I mean by this is I'm certainly happy to probably co-sponsor if we see a good plan, application of maybe certain tools such as tax abatements and others in this area.
Like everyone who lives there, he knows V, but he's not quite sold on the idea yet. It sounds nice, but he has a lot of the same questions that we have. How is he going to attract all these businesses to his project? And where's the money?
I don't know if this is the type of project, particularly given that we're contributing $28 million a block or two north. I don't know if this is the type of dollar for a project for city funds directly to be put into. And frankly, I can't be sure of that yet because I don't know the full contours of what the project is. I'm excited by the idea, and I'm excited by what he has planned, but I would certainly hope that significant private capital takes the lead in this project.
Is it something that you think is realistic, or is this a nice dream?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's realistic if we put a lot of work to it. And by work, I don't mean meeting with people who say, cool idea.
And there are a lot of people who have said, cool idea. V-Wiser keeps a whole binder full of letters of support from organizations and individuals around the city. Back in his office, V showed me.
People that are want to join in with us as we build this is the National Association for Black Veterans. They've given us a letter of support, and we have a project for them. We have Associated Wholesale Grocers that are has given us a letter of participation to build our grocery store, which we know that we're in a food desert.
As much support as V has from organizations, they're more like pats on the back than money. That has been the biggest question all along, and it remains the biggest question. But as he has through his entire life, V has faith that this will work out. And just a few weeks ago, he took one small step forward. C.S. Carey, a recycling company in Kansas City, donated their new forest mower to help remove all the trees and the brush growing on part of V's property, right across from the Kansas City Neighborhood Academy, the same building where V went to elementary school. It may not seem like much, but for Marvin Lyman, the president of the Black Economic Union, It was huge.
We can stand here and see the school when just, you know, over the past several years, we haven't been able to do that. That is just, just for young people to come out and not see an overgrown forest.
He says the simple act of clearing the blight will allow students and the community to really envision what that space could be. He's in full support of V's plan, by the way. And as for V, he watches that machine mow down trees and overgrowth with tears in his eyes.
Boy, I don't have words, cannot express yet really what's going on in my heart right now. This is the first steps to a new beginning.
On this day, V sees a path finally starting to clear. Where it will lead, however, is uncertain. Could this be the first tangible step toward building a more inclusive tech scene? Maybe. Money is obviously going to be an issue, as are politics and a long-standing mistrust between residents and developers. But what does seem certain is that the need for projects like V's is not going away.
That was KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez appearing on an episode of St. Louis Public Radio's We Live Here. Time for a break. When we come back, an update on life in the Flint Hills with Cindy Hodel. I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we mastered the Midwestern accent. Also, Ralph Nader shared an important lesson in an unlikely way. You can go to kcur.org/up-to-date to hear those conversations. Tomorrow, we'll look at the documentary that celebrates the 20th anniversary of the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve. Also, the life of Coach Fog Allen, one of the most influential men in basketball, and the man they named the field house after over in Lawrence. Well, we haven't heard from Cindy Hodel in a while. She lives down in the Flint Hills, where the sunsets are ravishing and the people can be pretty darn interesting. Nice to have you back. Welcome back, Cindy.
Hi, Happy Steve. Holidays. This is so fun. Thanks for having me.
And just a quick note, that story we just heard in the first part of the hour was inspired by a profile written for the Kansas City Star by Cindy Hodel. How did you come across that story about a tech hub here on Kansas City's east side?
Oh, V. Weiser Dixon.
Yeah, right.
I couldn't hear the show loud enough in the room I was sitting in. I'm glad I could remember his name.
Yeah.
What a cool person. That was one of those where you go out on a story and you just keep asking people questions that are entirely off topic, which is why my stories always took too long to write, but then they always led me to more stories.
Yeah.
And I met him through another person that I was writing about, and I think I was having lunch at Danny's Big Easy, which I am just tragically sad to hear of its closing.
Demise in the 18th and Vine Jazz.
I heard about B. Weiser, and I said, I've got to meet this man. And I called him up, and then he met me right away.
Can he do what he wants to do, creating this tech hub in the 18th and Vine area? Is that possible?
Oh, I think so, definitely.
Yeah.
But I think everything is possible. I think you just have to do it. And I think he is doing it, and it's amazing some of the national support that he's gotten.
That's great. Well, you're switching gears right now in your life. Tell us about the big change and what you're doing and how it's going and everything else. You have such a huge following on Facebook. People are so interested. Yeah,
so I think everyone knows by now I was laid off from the Kansas City Star. And it sounds odd, but when I got the phone call, I was driving to an interview for work. I was in my car because that's the only way people can reach me at the Star, you know.
Yeah.
And they were very nice, but they said, you know, sorry, the position's been eliminated. And I just had this euphoria kind of settle over me because, of course, I saw it coming and I'd been planning for it and kind of excited about it for a while.
You saw it coming. Why? In what way?
Steve, you and I had survived, 19 rounds of layoffs?
Okay, yeah. But you were so good, and I didn't.
You're very kind. Part of it was, and I probably shouldn't say this because I don't know if it's true, but you start to look around the room and you kind of have an idea of what the salaries are like. And and it's, you know, it started to become more and more clear that, you know, mine was probably one of the more juicy ones if they were looking to eliminate some costs, which they've just been forced to do.
Hard transition for you or not really?
No, not at all, because the Star really is the only grown-up job I ever had. It's the only corporation I ever worked for, the only place I ever had health insurance, right? And I did that for 20 years, and it was a gas, but before that I had my own company and I actually made more money. So there's no fear about being able to make a living.
You have your own business again. Are you heading that way? Or
I'm working on it, yeah, Steve.
What do you have in mind?
I'm piddling around a lot, but of course, I'm just talking to a lot of people about projects having to do with writing, having to do with editing. The business I had before was doing translations, written translating work for German companies from when I lived in Germany.
Yeah.
And when I went to work for the Star, I gave that up and kind of took a pay cut, but I don't regret it at all. It was, I had a wonderful time with the Star. Mm-hmm. But so there's that. But I'm also really excited about maybe doing something completely different and entrepreneurial. I think that's the new economy, is entrepreneurial undertakings. And I want to invest more and have businesses be more a part of where I live, my county and my town.
You mentioned to us that you're making things happen instead of writing about people who do. And I've thought about that before. We've spent our careers writing about others as opposed to being the ones who do the stuff that people write about. That's got to be kind of a neat transition or a neat place to be.
Yeah, I don't know how universal that is among journalists, but it was like the great thing and the frustrating thing about being a journalist. You go out and you meet these people that have these fascinating jobs and they're doing these amazing things. And you go, wow, it's great. I get to meet all these people and have entree into these exciting worlds. But like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if like that was my job? Every person that I interviewed when I was driving away, I thought like, wow, that'd be a great job. I'd like to be an architect. I'd like to be a pilot. I'd like to be a dog rescuer, whatever it was. You know?
That's what we are. We think everything's interesting. And my kids say that to me all the time. What's your show about tomorrow? I'll say, well, we're doing this thing on that. And it's kind of neat. And my sons will say, you find everything kind of interesting. I guess that's a disease or something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
The world's interesting. Yeah.
I don't know how universal it is among journalists, but you and I both share it. People always said, what do you write about? Like when I was at the magazine and I could never put my finger on it because I didn't have a beat. But what I discovered was if you're passionate about something, I want to know you and I want to know all about it because I love people that have a passion for anything, whatever it is. And so I started thinking, okay, what could I do, you know? And right after I got laid off, this little old house across the street from me came up for sale and I just bought it. And so my husband is a builder, a contractor, and so he can do everything. And so we just started, you know, fixing the house up. I mean, right now it's still kind of in the deconstruction phase, but it's just a cute, solid little house. And I have a million ideas for what we could do.
That sounds good. What are you going to do with it?
I know, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
Mainly just to have another house.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've doubled my property holdings in Matfield Green, right? So
is there much demand for those houses when they come up in Matfield?
Yes and no. It depends. If there's probably more demand for the houses that are in turnkey condition that have been fixed up and remodeled for people that want to move into town coming from Wichita, coming from Kansas City, coming from Topeka. The houses that are kind of in really rough shape, it's a risk if you're not able to do the work yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm lucky with my husband's skill set and my energy level and now having some free time, we can do stuff. And you can get them so cheaply, and it's something I'm willing to invest in and excited in investing in. And we're already putting local kids to work, helping with some of the work.
Wasn't any kind of bidding war for this house? I mean, several people who wanted it, or that just doesn't happen?
There were two other local people.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, but I think everybody had kind of a high number that they were not going to go past because it was just in rough shape.
Mm-hmm.
And my high number was maybe a little bit higher than theirs was.
Huh. You're also accidentally getting in shape after being adopted by a ranch dog.
Okey.
What's all this?
You know, life is so funny. It's like things just happen to you sometimes. And my husband and I had agreed to not get a dog because we both like to travel. And it's just fun when your kids are out of the house to really be able to go on road trips and not have to deal with pets. And so we were happy with the barn cats because they can fend for themselves.
Yeah.
But then this dog just adopted us and he's a beautiful Australian shepherd, but he's a working dog and he's very high energy. So he needs to be walked a lot and had the stick thrown a lot. And that was a new thing for me, you know, taking a dog for a walk. And what's great is where we live, you don't have to have them on a leash, right? So you just go out and you can walk for miles and no other cars come along. So he is just so fast. And what I would find is I've never had any desire to jog, but something childlike would bubble up in me when I would see him race out in front of me. And I would think like, okay, I can keep up with you. So I would just start like running as fast as I could.
Well, what do you mean he adopted you? You just came, he just showed up
in
your yard?
He just kept showing up in town. He had been bounced from a couple of homes and ended up on a ranch of some good friends of ours south of town. But they both work during the day and he's just sociable and he kind of just wanted to be around people. So he kept coming into town. So they had to, because Mike and I are usually, somebody's always home at our house. So he just kept showing up every day and our friends had to keep stopping on their way home from work and picking him up and taking him home. And after a couple of weeks of that, you know, they kind of started hinting around like, gee, it seems like Oki really likes you guys.
Yeah.
So we took him.
You know, some folks might think that this time of year, isn't today or coming up next couple of days the solstice and the darkest?
The solstice, you
bet.
Yeah,
you know, and it's, you're out in the country and it's dark and the socializing that you've described so vividly to us out in the gazebo and during the warm weather months probably isn't happening quite as often. I'm just guessing here. How is this time of year working for you?
I love it. So you talk about the summer or the winter solstice and the darkness. One reason I'm excited about buying the house across the street is because the wonderful old man who lived there before, he paid extra money to keep the street light in front of his house turned on when the city wanted to turn them all off as a budget saving measure. And I wanted to turn them all off as a stargazing measure. But he paid the electric company extra money every week to keep his street light on. And so after he died and I bought the house, the first thing I did was put in a call to have the street light turned off. And so it's darker now. And
what are you seeing up in the sky these days?
You can see the Milky Way from my front yard. It's unbelievable. Even when there's a full moon, you can see more stars than you can count. And I'm proud of getting the locals kind of more excited about stuff like the summer and winter solstice, which were not words in their vocabulary before I moved to town. The first year I was there, I organized a summer solstice party. We went out in trucks out on the open range to watch, you know, the sun go down on the longest day. And they were all kind of embarrassed about it. And what if somebody drives by and sees us doing this? Like, we look like tourists. But then the next year, one of those cowboys asked me if we were going to have the summer salsa party again.
Whatever that party was. Well, do you know now, after being out there for a while, can you look up in the sky and recognize the different constellations? Because I always have been mad at myself that that's not something I've ever quite gotten done, that I can look up in the sky and turn on my sun and say, well, that's Achilles or whatever the different ones are up there.
Yeah, no, I only know the same ones that I knew when I was a kid.
The Milky
you know,
Way.
Like I can pick out, what is it? Orion is the big H.
And
Cassiopeia,
right.
The W, the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, I can see now. I could never see that in the city. But I haven't learned as much about that as I'm planning to. Mm-hmm. You know, all these great plants, you know, I thought as soon as I moved to Matfield, I'm going to learn to identify trees and birds
yes,
and
I've
stars
always wanted to do that too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's still on the list.
Yeah.
Do
you have a list?
Yeah, in my head.
Like, what else is on it?
So identifying trees, you know, I've noticed that the locals know so much more than I do in so many ways. I have more years of college than most of them, but I feel really ignorant when I'm around them because they know about the real world. They know
exactly. You just said that so well. That's the part of living I want to know more about. Yeah.
And that's why you would love it, because I love it, because every day you learn so much. You can't even walk into the gas station and sit there while you're getting your oil changed without overhearing two ranchers talking about stuff. And you learn about grass and animals and weather and amazing things every day.
Well, are people getting together? Do the neighbors get together weekends or is that sort of slowed down?
So it slows down a little bit because nobody's socializing outside in this weather. But I have to say, you know, we've had this amazing warm fall. And so we were on my gazebo in November on the day of the November supermoon.
Yeah.
And then we all dragged up to this high spot on a friend's pasture land. And gosh, there was 13 of us, I think, in like four or five trucks. And we watched the November super moon rise, and it was just stunning, and it was gorgeous weather. I think we were out there until 10 o'clock at night, maybe that night. So it's a pretty short period where, you know, typically when the weather's really nasty, but yeah, things slow down, but there's also always events in Cottonwood Falls that are planned, and the Bizarre Schoolhouse.
What else do you do on the weekends? I mean, what else happens with you and Mike? What do you guys do?
One of our favorite things to do, and we still do it in the wintertime because everybody has trucks with good tires, and like there's ply numbers that I had never heard of before. Like as a city person, I heard of like four ply tires, right? Well, they know about like eight ply and 10 ply out there, right? And so
these are things I don't know anything about. Yeah.
We call it boonie cruising. And so we just like put a cooler in the pickup truck and, you know, just go for a ride in an extended cab truck, you know, with four or six people and just go out and drive the back roads and just look at the scenery, and it's amazing. And even the locals enjoy doing that, you know, looking at the deer and the turkey and the frozen creeks.
Oh, that's great. There's been a mini population boom in Matfield, I understand. What's happening along those lines?
Yeah, so it's really exciting. You know, when Mike and I moved in, we increased the population by 4%. You know, that's a town of 50 people, right? And then since we moved in, we've had two new young couples move in, one young couple from Hillsborough and one from Peabody. And one couple had one young child already, and then they had another baby. And then we have a local family that has three young children. So, yeah, the average age is just plummeting with all these new babies. And
Is that a good thing?
It's a wonderful thing because in all seriousness, I mean, I look at rural population loss seriously. I've researched it, and it's a serious problem. And any time that you can have young families moving into dying towns, that's what it's all about.
You know, one time you were on the show a while back and you were talking about the one tavern in town. And I've been by it. And it had
the Hitch and Post.
The Hitch and Post. And it had closed. Is that still the state of affairs with the Hitch and Post?
Yes. And
that's got to change.
Yeah, no, but we're working on it. And that's another thing that, you know, I might have a role in. I don't know. We're trying to figure out, a lot of us in town, everyone wants the bar back.
You'd be good at that, Cindy.
And somebody told me you should do it because then the stories would come to you if you ran the bar. But there's problems. There's physical problems with that specific building.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but now I just bought this property. And in addition to this cute old house, it's on three lots.
Right.
And so there's actually room there where you could build something.
Oh,
and so,
great.
But I'm a little bit lazy. And so I've kind of been thinking about my favorite bars in Florida, where it's just like an open air gazebo and like beers on ice in a stock tank and a Weber grill. And it's only open during nice weather.
Well,
but
you
I think
can't
I do
an
do
open
that.
Air thing in Matfield Green, can you? Hey, listen, always good to have you here. Happy holidays to you. Merry Christmas.
Steve,
great to
Merry
see you,
Christmas.
Cindy.
Thanks for having me.
Come back
me.
And see us in a few months, okay?
Love to.
Well, Bill Brownlee's here with this week's Local Listen, local act doing some interesting things musically. And Bill, nice to have you. Happy holidays.
Same to you, Steve.
Here you are, yeah. Tell us about the Floozies. What are the Floozies?
Well, we have a band with a ridiculous name making ridiculous music, but it's gleeful, silly fun. I'm a big fan.
Well, let's listen to the Floozies. This is Granola Jones from their 2016 EP by the same name, The Floozies.
I'm
This is the Floozies. They're a Lawrence-based electronic funk duo, and that's something different, Bill.
It's something different, and it's something old, too. You know, I'm sure you remember the funk classic More Bounce to the Ounce by Zapp.
Yeah.
Or Isaac Hayes' Walk On By.
Yeah.
I hear elements of both of those songs in this new music by the Floozies.
Who are they?
It's two brothers from Lawrence, Matt and Mark Hill.
Hill,
They've been at this for a while, and they've since become one of the most popular area-based music ensembles.
Well, they're popular locally, but they also have something of a following nationally on the summer festival circuit. Do I have that right?
That's right. Anytime the big electronic dance music artists headline outdoor events, you know, there's a slew of up-and-coming bands that perform ahead of them, and the Floozies are one of those acts. On Spotify, they have millions of streams. This is a real band and popular enough to headline the Midland for the second time this year.
Is this hard music to recreate in a live concert setting, or I don't have any sense of how that would happen with a sound like this?
I think computers have a lot to do with it.
Computers. Well, of course. What am I thinking? That's the answer to every problem in America today, right?
It makes the need to actually, you know, plunk guitar strings or hit notes on keyboards superfluous.
Do these guys ever sing, or is it strictly instrumental?
They put on a really energetic live show, and there actually will be some guys playing live instrumentation along with the laptop computers on Friday at the Midland.
That's amazing. And there's lots of free downloads available here. Do I have that right?
Yeah, one reason they're popular, I think, Steve, is in addition to all the streams they get on the streaming services, fans can download everything they've recorded for free.
Okay. Well, that's the Floozies. This track, again, Granola Jones. We'll listen to a little bit more of it. Bill Brownlee, always good to have you here. Happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, from the Floozies to Steven Steigman.
Thank you for making me follow the Floozies.
Our senior producer here. We have some changes of note going on here at Up to Date, and we thought we'd let our listeners know in the final seconds we have of today's show. And you're transitioning after being the founding producer of Up to Date with me almost 15 years ago.
14 and a half years or so,
yeah.
It's been a good run.
It's been a really good
run. Man, it's been a good run.
What are you going to be doing?
I'm actually going to be doing a lot of the same things I'm already doing now, but a whole bunch of new duties. I'm still continuing to oversee KCUR's broadcast operations while at the same time exploring new national programs as well as partnering with our colleagues here at KCUR to share the stories of the greater Kansas City community.
Oh, that's great. Well, and I'm just for the record, want to say that, you know, it can be a difficult position, a relationship between host and producer, because we have so many decisions we've got to make here every day about who's the guest going to be and how many guests we want to have and how long is the segment going to go and what should the segment be to begin with. And as a result, the relationship between producer and host can be fraught with peril. And we did it for almost 15 years.
That's right. And you know what?
I'm really proud of that, by the way.
So am I. I've heard about a lot of producers and hosts who don't get along, and some only last like 3 or 4 years. Actually, 4 years is like the average out there. So to last, you know, almost 15 years, I'd say that says something about you.
Well, I think it says something about you, actually. We did well. And so your ties to the show will be more tenuous now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I'll be around. I'll be around here every day. I don't think anybody's going to see me go away, but I won't have my hands dipping into the show. But we have a fantastic staff here at Up to Date to take on this show and move it to the next step.
Well, you're not going away completely, but I'm going to be for a couple of weeks just to let our listeners know. I'm getting a new left hip tomorrow morning.
So hip, hooray!
Yes, my days of hobbling are about about to come to an end, and I've been off painkillers for a few days now, so I can't wait for tomorrow. So you'll have Brian Ellison and others here for a couple of weeks, and hopefully I'll be back. I'll be a much better host with a better left hip.
You're already a great host, and I wish you a very good surgery and a strong recovery.
Well, Stikes, it's been a pleasure. All the best.
Pleasure.
Good luck
Thank
in the
you.
New role.
Thank
you,
Steve.
Bet. On tomorrow's program, we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve and the life of a basketball coaching legend, that's KU's Fog Allen. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer, that's Steven Steigman. For a couple more days, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.